Okay, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 129, I believe.
Eight.
You keep correcting me every time, and usually you're wrong.
Well, last time, did you do an episode since I saw you last?
I think so.
Okay, then it's 129. Okay.
I'm releasing some swap casts too. So like we did one with False Reality Check. So I think I'm gonna put that one out too. And I need to put out the one we did Friday night and and I did one on Sunday too. Oh. We did one with I've been busy and I usually don't have all these episodes stacked up like this, and this is like the first time I've ever had it. So I got to get some out because I haven't released one since Thursday. It's already Tuesday. So yeah. But yeah, the weather is incredible right now. It's so amazing. It's like 75 degrees out.
Nice.
It's so nice, Deborah.
It's a late spring for the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, really, really late. But hopefully it comes around and sticks around this time. We've had a couple nice days, but finally, it's great. I went out and I did all this stuff to help with the weather manipulation yesterday. And hopefully it makes a difference. So
what is your manipulation?
I buried stuff in the ground.
Okay. And what's that going to do?
It's supposed to do all sorts of things. You got to go back. You got to go listen to our episode with Mitch, the organ donor.
Okay.
And so I went out there and did that. And now it's super duper nice outside. I spent the last few days, like the last week, just trying to figure out how to get this little piece of fence up, and I finally did it. So I'm pretty happy about that. Our chickens are safe again.
Good.
So yeah, little lambs are in there with the chickens.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Are they weaned?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're full. They ate so much grass. I had them in this little section of the chicken coop, all fenced off, and they were but they ate all the grass in there, so I had to get this section of fence up to be able to let them out. Otherwise I'd have to just keep doing these little temporary pens for them, and it's a pain to do. It takes forever, and then you just got to move them anyway. So
yeah,
I got them on a bunch of grass in the chicken run area. So yeah, cool. They're getting all fat. They're super friendly.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Even Leonard?
I just have the two little baby girls together, and I've been training them to be friendly so that I can milk them when they get bred.
Yeah.
And look at this.
Look who's there.
Wow. Chud X, you look, you've started your transition. You haven't talked publicly with the show about it, but you've started your metamorphosis into a mother and female homesteader.
Excuse me for one second, because I want to show Lanny something.
Okay. Oh, I'm excited.
Hey guys, we're doing a special episode. So Lanny set this all up, aka Mrs. Chud X, and she's going to be taking the reins on this one. So no Chud X, but Lanny is here. How's it going, Lanny?
Look at that. It's going great. Hey, that's excellent.
Yeah, Deborah's showing off a jar of
green beans, jelly beans.
Yep.
That she is
fermenting.
That's fantastic, Deborah.
Thank you.
Check this out. Look how beautiful this is.
Ooh, that's a nice color. Is that
the
kombucha with beets?
Yeah, it's so good. Watch.
That's awesome. I got to try that. I haven't done beets before with my booch.
Oh, it didn't pop. Ooh. This one didn't. It didn't pop. But
it sounded good on the microphone.
It's been the only time that it's been super carbonated. So I think a bunch of sugar that you buy at the store is from beets. Yeah, so I think beets have a ton of sugar in them. So I think the secondary fermentation really worked well with these, because it's been up until recently, it's been cold, and these did secondary ferment on the shelf for like 4 days.
That's great.
Yeah, I did beets, apple juice, one little baby like cutie tangerine thing, and ginger. It's so good.
Did you run that stuff through your juicer? Is that?
Yeah, we had some like pressed apple juice that we got at the store, so it wasn't fresh apples like off the farm, but the other stuff was juiced, and then I just put like some unfiltered apple juice in.
Cool.
Yeah, it's yeast really
bacteria on it too, because it gets wild. Oh, yeah. Did I freeze? Oh,
yeah, you froze for a second.
I'm back.
Yeah.
You're back.
It's funny because it when you freeze, like everything you said while you're frozen speeds up to catch up.
It's weird. Then I sound like I really know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So what's going on? What's going on with you, Lanny?
Oh, we just moved the meat birds outside because that was getting out of hand. They're growing so fast.
Did they stink up your house?
Well, we had them in the basement, but yes. Yeah, you could hear them through the floor like chirping. It was yeah.
How many were there?
There were 26. There's now 23. We've lost three of them.
Yeah, that's about what I lost when I did it too.
Failure to thrive. Yeah, not really happens. Any reason.
That's why they send you extras.
Yeah. Yep. We got one extra. We've lost three total. But we moved them outside into one of our troughs. In a dog kennel cage, so that nothing can get into them. And then the heat lamps in there, it's covered with the tarp. So we're gonna have to watch and see how that goes, just until they're big enough that we can move them to the chicken tractor.
Yeah. How'd you feel about doing those beans, Deborah? Was it hard?
No, but I did, they're supposed to be arriving tomorrow, purchase some weights.
Oh, cool.
Because what I ended up doing is taking a smaller jar and filling it with water and putting it in, hoping it would keep everything down. It didn't, but it made the water level rise. So
did it just like fall down inside? I've done that before. Is it in there?
It's still in there.
Yeah.
But everything's covered with the brine.
You know, so. We have actually a listener and fan of Deborah Gets Red Pilled that I've now met locally here, Max. He was doing some fermentation before my workshop, and he just puts his stuff into a canning jar and seals it. And then once a day, he opens it and lets the gases out. But he also once a day flips it over and lets it sit upside down for a while so that everything floats to the other end. Just as long as you keep that moving, as long as you keep disturbing the surface, it's not going to give it enough time for mold to start to form on the top.
Okay.
I thought that was kind of cool, dude. There's so many different ways to do it. And that's part of what makes it fun. But yeah, weights might make it easier for you.
Yeah. I unscrew the lid, but it does. I mean, would a lid like that, would I hear the gas come out?
You might, but what day are you on? How many days has that been?
I forget what day I did it, but I can sample it on June 2nd.
June 2nd. Okay. So you might just not have it be that fizzy yet, or you might just be burping it enough. Usually things for me get active like around 3 or 4 days, really active, and then they kind of slow down again and level off. Okay.
All right.
So as long as you don't forget about it.
I'm really looking forward to Sunday's workshop. Fermented beverages.
Yes.
So I know how to do kombucha pretty well. I'm getting good at it. But yeah, I'm really excited to learn how to do kvass. Maybe, what else in there? Water kefir or no?
We're going to talk about water kefir. We're going to talk about beet kvass. We're going to talk about fruit kvass and tapache and herbal root beer and ginger beer. And we'll cover like a ginger bug starter, like it's basically like a sourdough starter, but for sodas. So using ginger and sugar and water, you collect a colony of wild yeast, and then you're able to use that to start other ferments, like other fermented sodas.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, so, I'm really looking forward to it. I got, Emily bought me kefir grains, so I rehydrated those, and I'm back in business on that front.
Milk kefir grains?
Yeah.
So you did say goodbye officially to the ones that I gave
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I couldn't rescue them. They were not doing it right. There was this gross pink yeast was
yep.
mold yeast was forming on the top of every batch that I did. And it wasn't getting thick. I was just super busy and our house was under construction and I was just letting them go too long to where there was like separating.
Yeah.
And it was just, I think, overworking them, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And then they get too hungry and then they start trying to get whatever they can. It seems like then they take on other bacteria can start to take over, like, cause they're not strong or something, you know, it's interesting. Yeah. Cultural manipulation.
Yeah. But that's a funny way to put it. The mayonnaise I made is absolutely fantastic.
That's so cool.
It's so good. And all it was is like a tablespoon of whey that I just, I was going to try to get some out of some old, some yogurt that she had. Mm-hmm. So I was going to like put it in a coffee filter and strain it out. And I just like opened up this old thing of yogurt and it wasn't rotten, but all the whey had separated.
Oh,
it
yeah.
was like on the top. So I just used that. Yeah.
Perfect. It's so awesome to not be afraid of your food anymore.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Cause I was totally worried about food poisoning all the time when I was younger till I learned all this stuff.
I'm really excited. The apple trees are just blossoming and super beautiful right now. There's a ton of them here. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm just going to start, as soon as they start falling off the tree, I'm just going to start juicing as many as possible and putting them in freezable containers and doing all that. So there's probably 8 trees here. And yeah, they really.
I bet you can make an apple soda, carbonated apple soda, just using a ginger bug. When we go, we'll go over that in the workshop.
Oh, that's my favorite. What's the Mexican apple soda that I used to always get?
I can't think of it. I can't.
An apple is called a manzana. I forget what it's called. I used to always get it at the taco stand.
Huh. Apple soda, never.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah. So. And then when you're making this stuff at home, you're controlling what kind of sugar and how much sugar. And if you're fermenting stuff, then you're also reducing the sugar just because the yeast eats it.
Yeah.
So it's
Cedrol.
Like, there you go.
Yeah.
That's what it was called, Cedrol?
Cedrol, yeah. It's
that was a different one than I was thinking of. I had, there was a guy at work that always drank that stuff too, but it was started with an M. And then I think of Martinelli's, you know, like the sparkling apple cider stuff, but this would be like next level if you're making it with fresh pressed apple juice.
Yeah. And well, like Lang, you wanted to come on today and you lined all this stuff up. So thanks for that. Cause we've been kind of light on the shows lately.
Yeah.
What are we going to get into today?
So I'm using you guys because I want to have this conversation with my mom and I can't. So I'm living through Deborah, and I appreciate that, Deborah, you're a good sport. But I've also, since before I was friends with you, Adam, and when I was just a listener, I was like, it would be great to have them talk about the history of diet nutrition. You know, who came up with the food pyramid and what science is that based on? And what role did the sugar industry play in that? And who was Kellogg? The Kellogg's company.
Yeah.
Like all of that stuff is really, really interesting when you dig into it. And it was really eye-opening for me when I started digging into that. It was really my first, I mean, I already was, I didn't trust authority, you know, all growing up, but it wasn't until I really started digging into the food industry that I started to think maybe there was an agenda to keep us sick and keep us not knowing the truth, you know, going against nature. And so, I listened to, Godcast, the Goodness Over Darkness podcast. And they had this nice lady on, her name's Katie, and she is a dietitian and she's talked about her own health journey, after having like stomach issues her whole life to feeling well. And she talked also a lot about the history that I'm familiar with, but I'm just not good enough studied to name names and dates and stuff like that. So I thought it would be really fun to be on the show and have her come on so we could have this conversation together.
Fantastic. Cool. Yeah, we did that one. I guess I told you we'd only done one other health one, but then you pointed out we did do the Allison Pillow episode, and that one was pretty good, but it didn't deal with a lot of history and stuff. But like I said, early on, we had Tim James on, and it was there's probably two that really stand out as bad episodes to me, and I think that was one of them.
And I'm not familiar with him. So I wasn't sure, and I hadn't listened to that one.
He gave me he wanted me to call him the health hero on the show. And he, you know, I think a lot of people in alternative media use him, and he has like promo codes for all this green powder and stuff. He was a nice enough guy to come on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he did. He had done Truthzilla like the week before, and he had like a podcast spiel, and it was like the exact same thing.
Okay, yeah, then that can be kind of boring if everybody says it the exact same way.
And then he told us like that we needed to get like the water we drink's bad, and we need to do this certain thing to drink this water, and then but he wouldn't like really explain what it was. And I looked into it, and it consisted of buying like this like $14,000 filter like that you could install in your home. But I listened to Katie's episode as well. I was on the couch and I'm super tired, so I fell asleep at the end for a lot of the history stuff.
Uh-huh.
So hopefully I can be surprised by some of it. But she's in the waiting room.
Yeah.
So let's pause and we'll let her in, and we'll be right back.
Sounds great.
Okay, guys, we're back, and we're happy to be here with our extra special guest today, who is Katie Lopez. So Katie is a registered dietitian, nutritionist. She has specialties in diabetes care and education, parenteral and enteral nutrition. Is that correct?
Parenteral and enteral, but a lot of people say parenteral, so that's okay. Totally fine.
And food sensitivity testing and treatment. She's been working in the traditional healthcare system for over 15 years. And Katie's perspective centers around the circadian and spiritual aspects of health practices and food choices. And she enjoys watching people transform their health by changing their identity and tapping into their God-given intuition. That sounds fantastic. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here. So you were on Godcast with our friend Emmanuel, aka Todd, and Mimi, and you also participated in a Bible study with them, right?
Yep, that's right.
Cool. And I listened to that podcast, and you have a really interesting story, and it's really way more fun than listening to somebody just talk about health for an hour and a half. So you know about history, and you have a wild, wild story yourself, and then you weave health and wellness all into that. So yeah, let's get going.
Awesome. Happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah.
So I was super excited to have you on because a lot of the stuff you kind of touched on when you were on the Goodness Over Darkness podcast was the kind of the history of the nutritional guidelines and the, you know, the Ansel Keys and the sugar industry and all of that kind of stuff. So I'd love to touch into that, but maybe if you could start by telling a little bit about your story to health and how that came about.
Sure. So I grew up in Iowa, in a really rural community. So my mom wasn't home a lot because she was a nurse, and she went back to do her nurse practitioner when I was in high school. So she was working, she was getting her nurse practitioner. My dad wasn't there either. He had left when I was a kid. So my mom was a single parent. There were four kids. So we were doing a lot of things, kind of like you were describing. The diet in the 80s was really interesting. So I remember my sister and I talk a lot about what we would eat as kids, and we would never give this to our kids knowing what we know now. So we grew up, I remember we would drink a lot of green Kool-Aid and eat a lot of macaroni and cheese when my mom wasn't home. And the school lunches, we ate just the public school lunches.
The styrofoam tray school lunches.
Yeah. I still remember the menus from my elementary school. I just, you know, I remember, those were the types of foods that we ate. We ate a lot of cereal. I remember, so my friends would go to, I remember before basketball games, we would go and fuel up for basketball games. And we would go to the Hardee's in my town. Hardee's is a fast food restaurant in the Midwest for anybody who doesn't know what it is.
It's the same as Carl's Jr., I think.
Yep. That's right. And I remember my friends would all go there and they would get just like a hamburger meal with French fries and a soda. And I would not eat it because I thought I was being healthy. And I would eat like two bowls of Raisin Bran before my basketball games. And so I had a stomach ache. So my mom said I was vaginally delivered. I was breastfed for probably at least a year. And she said that I came out of the womb sick and I had a flat affect. I never felt good. I was always bloated. I was constipated even as a baby. So I had stomach aches literally since infancy. And then when I got into elementary school, I was always sick then too. So my parents were always taking me to the doctor to try to figure out why my stomach was aching. And I was always complaining of stomach aches. And then I started having headaches in elementary school too. So I had workups and they were always normal. And then nobody really changed my diet because we just thought what we were doing was healthy, you know, eating cereal for breakfast, sandwiches for lunch. And then for supper, we would have hamburgers and a potato or something like that, and then snack on fruits throughout the day. So there wasn't really any insight into why I was having these issues, but the doctors would always just say, it's probably a psychosomatic thing because I was a straight A student and I wanted to compete and I wanted to do really well in school, even at a young age. And so my mom was always just telling me to relax and that the system does this. They just put it back on the patient. They just say, you know, just get your head screwed on straight and you'll feel better. So, kind of fast forward when it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago, I had some functional testing done and my labs came back and it showed that I was pre-diabetic. So I just thought that was crazy because I had always been an athlete. I have always been lean and thin. At that point, I hadn't had any children. So I couldn't understand why I would have a high hemoglobin A1C. I was really shocked. So at the time I was working in outpatient oncology for a big academic center in Chicago. And one of my coworkers, one of the radiation oncologists that I work with, she was using low carb diets in her patients. And none of the dietitians would talk to her because they thought this was blasphemy or this was a dangerous, reckless thing to be doing, to tell cancer patients not to eat sugar or to make any dietary restrictions at all. That was kind of the attitude. So, but I would always hear her out and she was having pretty good results because her patient population was a lot of sort of like postmenopausal women or premenopausal women with metabolic syndromes. And so a lot of the women's cancers are tied into metabolic disease. So when you can reverse the insulin resistance, that's the main target for a lot of metabolic doctors is they will focus on insulin and bringing insulin levels down with diet. And so she was able to do that with really good success and patients would have less chemotoxicity. They would have just better outcomes overall. So she would follow the patients long-term. They would have better outcomes by changing their diet this way. So I've always been a really open-minded person. I've always been somebody who, I shouldn't say always, but I've always wanted to learn, I guess, is a strength that I have. I've always had a curiosity and a strength. So I try, I've had my biases and my dogmas, but I always want to learn and I'm more curious. So I guess that trumps the dogmatic piece. So I always tend to hear people out and hear their perspectives and ideas because I find it interesting. So I would always hear her out. And so I decided, well, since I am myself, I'm insulin resistant, probably. Why don't I try a low carb diet? So I did. And my abdominal pain for the first time in 35 years was better. So I suffered my entire life. It affects when you have abdominal pain, any gastrointestinal issues, it affects every part of your life. So socially, it was really difficult. College was in high school were really difficult because I was sick all the time. Dating is really difficult because you're trying to enjoy food and social experiences and you just can't because you just don't know how you're going to feel by the end of the night. So a lot of times I just wouldn't eat. So other people would be enjoying food and my go-to plan would be just to not eat and then I would be hungry. But being hungry was better than having some sort of abdominal pain or bloating if I was eating the wrong foods. So
was there like a go-to meal that you could rely on that wouldn't hurt your stomach?
Until I figured it out, no. But when I was, so for me, it was kind of a progression. So I went low carb. So I did like a really, I did like a pretty strict ketogenic diet because I was really focused on diabetes for myself. So I would do a lot of not very much protein, not very much animal protein, but I would do a lot of vegetables and a lot of fats like butter, MCTs, stuff like that. So it was a really, really high fat. It would have been like a therapeutic on the therapeutic range of the ketogenic diet, something that you would use in for like glioblastoma patients or for epilepsy, that on that side of the spectrum of keto, even though it wasn't really indicated for my, you know, for diabetes, that's what I did anyway. And so I wasn't feeling the best on that all the time, probably because I made a few mistakes. You have to get your electrolytes right when you do it, and I didn't. So I made a lot of mistakes along the way. And then I figured out probably 3 years ago that I do better without vegetables. So now I have no abdominal pain, hardly ever. 95% of the time I have no abdominal pain. No gastrointestinal issues at all. And I eat almost all meat. So I eat a little bit of sourdough bread. I eat butter, eggs, cheese, fish, and meat is primarily my diet. And then once in a while, I might have a vegetable or a salad maybe 3 or 4 times a week. And I do, for me, this is the best that I feel.
And Deborah, from what you know about what is good for you and what you've been told and raised with and raised your kids with, does that sound like a healthy diet, just eating meat and butter and eggs and cheese?
Of course not. I mean, although the reason I'm kind of flipping out is I have a brother-in-law in Louisiana who has tried, you know, he's always on some new diet or some new program for self-improvement. And he went strictly meat and has been for, if he still is, which I assume he is, for years, just like you said, but no veggies, no fruits ever, just, you know, the meat. And he said the same thing. He feels so much better. And I would have thought for sure it was like the dairy or the sugar that was upsetting your stomach. It was the vegetables.
Yeah. And there was another book along the way that I read at some point. I think it was before I had my diagnosis, but I read this book called Fiber Menace by, I think his name is Ivan. It's a very Eastern European name, so I'm not going to say it because I'll butcher it. But the book is called Fiber Menace, and that really opened my eyes to a lot of things too. So he talks a lot about how there's no evidence supporting high fiber diets, and there's some evidence showing that they can be harmful. And then I just have to give this disclaimer too, because I am a medical professional. So any of the things that we talk about today is not medical advice. So everybody has to work with their doctor or their practitioner to find the diet that works best for them. But when I dug into the fiber literature, that was really interesting because it was just more epidemiology. So epidemiology is just really big studies where you look back. So you take a large group of people over a long period of time and you can look back and see what habits or behaviors they were doing. And then you can look at outcomes and then you can try to associate the two. So it's never a causal relationship that you're identifying. And that's a huge weakness in the field of nutrition because we have all this really, really weak science supporting all of our guidelines. And I think most of us don't realize until you either become really sick yourself or have a sick family member, or you get kind of burnt out using the same diet that we've been using since before the 60s, the same diet prescription. It's pretty much the same for every disease state. A plant-based diet, lower in fat with, you know, chicken and fish and lots of vegetables and lots of grains is pretty much the diet prescription for any illness in the traditional medical system. It's always the same diet, even though they put a different name on it. It's the same diet every time. So when you just see what I see every day, nobody's getting better. For me anyway, and with my own illness, it made me want to take a new perspective and hear some new ideas. So this guy who wrote this book called Fiber Menace, I couldn't believe what I was reading. And I was like, well, maybe fiber is the problem with me. And it turned out it really was. So I don't do well with fibers. And I know a lot of people who don't do well with high fiber diets. It just doesn't make them feel well. And so there's this huge movement now that was born out of sort of like a rebellion, because we have been creating, taking people's illnesses, prescribing this diet based on weak evidence for them, they get sicker. And then because of that, this carnivore diet was born out of this sickness rebellion, I would say. And then when people realize too, the evidence supporting all of the things that we're recommending is not strong, I think people, I was really desperate just to feel better. So I would have tried anything at that point. And so yeah, it's really trippy the way that I was trained. I've got 2 degrees in nutrition. I've got 6 years of, you know, post high school education in nutrition and lots of experience. And again, it's nothing that I was trained to do. So it's been a really, really interesting journey.
Yeah,
for sure. Wow. When in school and during your, do you learn the history of why they chose, you know, what healthy dietary guidelines are? Say like the food pyramid I know isn't what we're using today, but it was for such a long time. And that's what I think a lot of people still associate with what a balanced diet looks like.
Yeah. So we didn't learn any of that I can remember. So I feel like it's us. I mean, this is a podcast where we all speak the same language, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I feel like you guys will understand when I say the food pyramid and the dietary guidelines are a psyop, I feel like, because I don't remember looking into the history of the guidelines until afterwards when I heard from journalists. So the journalist that I heard the story from about the guidelines was Nina Teichholz. Mm-hmm. And she's the journalist who wrote on the dietary guidelines being funded basically by the sugar industry. And, you know, that's how marketing, I learned a lot about marketing from her and how if you can demonize certain foods, then you can monopolize and control the food system. And that's really what happened. And if you look back further than that, even though my favorite part of the story about the dietary guidelines is looking into the religious base part of it. And I think you guys probably heard me mention the Seventh-day Adventist religion.
Yeah. And was Kellogg a Seventh-day Adventist?
He was.
Yeah.
I grew up, I went to high school, Katie, in the Napa Valley, California.
Okay. Yeah.
Like wine country. And, I grew up in a town called St. Helena. It's a famous, winery town, little 5,000 people, but it's a destination for the wealthy elites of the world to go drink wine and go to spas. And in the hills above St. Helena is this little town called Angwin, A-N-G-W-I-N. And it is the international headquarters of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. There's a college there, Pacific Union College, which is an Adventist college. There's one grocery store that closes on Friday nights and doesn't open until whatever the Sabbath is over, and it's all like it's all soy products, you know.
They're like vegetarian, right? They believe in a vegetarian diet.
Yeah,
they do church on Saturdays.
Yep, and they shut down Friday nights. So
interesting.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So I have a very close friend who is a Seventh-day Adventist, and then I have another person who is a friend of mine who has a professor with back in when I was teaching in Chicago, and nicest people in the world. And one's a vegan, one's a vegetarian. And so I've gotten into a lot, I still do get into a lot of discussions with them about it. I've kind of tiptoed my way around the nutrition piece because they had their prophet was this lady named Ellen G. White. And she apparently had a vision that God spoke to her and told her all these things. I would have to go back and read exactly what God told her, but basically he said the way to health and the right thing to do and the moral thing to do is to avoid meat and to do vegetables, like a vegetable plant-based diet. So some people thought that she may have had some form of amnesia. I can't remember the form of a brain injury, basically, because when she was a little girl, somebody threw a rock at her head, a little kid threw a rock at her head. And so I think it was shortly after that, she started having these visions. And so she's their prophet. And so their religion is based on a lot of stuff that she heard from God, apparently. And the Seventh-day Adventist, it's called that because, like you said, they worship on Saturdays. So they're really, so my friend who's sending me information, because a lot of times when people are in these religions, they want to try to convert other people into their religion. So she's always sending me information propaganda about we're going to know when the end of the world is coming. And this has been their belief since the 1850s or 60s. We're going to know when the end is coming in the second coming of Christ, because the Vatican will create a new world order and they will make us worship on Sundays and we won't be allowed to worship on Saturdays. So
didn't they already have someone in the church that had called an end of the world scenario that did not come to fruition?
I think it's happened a few times.
Yeah.
I think so. They've been waiting 150 years for this to happen and they're really hanging their hats on it happening this time. So it just, for me, I get a little bit, I don't want to say anything negative about anyone's religion because I grew up in, my family is very devout Catholic.
Well, so you can, you can give, at least you can give the Seventh-day Adventists. They may not have predicted the second coming of Christ properly, but they sure did predict that the Vatican wanted to do the new world order. Cause they got right. That 100% right.
Yeah. So. Yeah, for sure. But I can't figure out, for me, it's just really hard to understand why they're so hung up on that. Yeah. They're so hung up on, they're Christians, but they believe in this old, I think it's an Old Testament belief about the day that we should keep holy, the Sabbath. And so I'll just, the reason I like to talk to Todd and Mimi is because we can get into the spiritual stuff. So for me, it's just hard to understand what is the point of life if it's all just about martyring somebody and worshiping on a certain day? That's what I really struggle with. And I haven't been able to say that to my friend yet. I don't think I ever will, but it's that piece is really hard for me to understand. I don't know if you guys have any insight into that.
I agree. It's curious because I know the story of Kellogg a little bit, and I know that he was involved with that church and had started like a sanitarium. Is that right?
Yeah. So he had a sanitarium. He invented sanitariums from what I understand. And the first one was in Battle Creek, Michigan, where he invented cereal, right?
Was a sanitarium kind of like a health retreat or health spa type deal?
Yep. So it would be a lot of people, and I got a lot of this from reading online, and I got a lot of it from the History Channel too. So the History Channel is, we know who's running the History Channel, but I felt like it was, they still gave some really interesting information. He started a sanitarium for people with a lot of mental issues, and then there would be chronic illnesses. So, and there were, at the time, there was a lot of gastrointestinal stuff going on too. So, but when you, I think this was pre-refrigeration, so it made sense to me that there would be a lot of issues with gastrointestinal at that time, a lot of IBS type symptoms back then even. So his cure for this was to put people on cereal and high fiber diets. And the Seventh-day Adventists are really good because they do community. They do positive thinking, sunlight, cold showers, exercise, sleep. So there's like seven pillars of health that they practice, and they do that really well. So when you look at the nutrition epidemiology, a lot of it is based on studying the Seventh-day Adventists. They don't do alcohol. So they live longer than someone in the general population because they're doing all these things right. But then they always will tie it back into plant-based or vegetarianism and say that's why. And not all of them are vegetarians, by the way, either. So it's a personal choice if they want to become a vegan or a vegetarian, but it's definitely promoted. And, they put that on a pedestal in that church. Obedience is a big thing in that church too. So, and interestingly, both of my friends who are now Seventh-day Adventists were Catholics before. So, and the same themes with Catholicism are there too, about the obedience and the sort of like the suffering and the martyrism, and a lot of the same elements with the dogmas are kind of carryover from what I've noticed. So Kellogg was big on introducing fiber because they also have some hangups about sex and reproduction. He was actually a eugenics doctor. I don't think a lot of people know that either. So he was really interested in like sterilization, and he thought, he was really opposed to masturbation. He was opposed to sex. So as I understand it, he wouldn't sleep in the same bed with his wife, and he would do anything just not to become aroused. So he formulated his diet in such a way so he wouldn't have any arousal.
Yeah. I've heard that thing that that cornflakes were supposedly to stop masturbation or something. And I guess that's a really basic, easy way to explain it. But yeah,
that meat and high fat diets would cause arousal, that these grain diets would curb that. Yeah.
Hey, I don't want to get too specific with my wife's mother on the line, but I went fully plant-based for about a year and a half, Katie, probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I was horribly unhealthy. I weighed like 135 pounds. I usually weigh like, I should weigh about 155. And I got pneumonia real bad. And I went to the doctor. I had pneumonia when I went to Deborah's house to ask her if I could marry her daughter. Aww. And poor guy. I had the sex drive of a 75-year-old man. And I weighed 135 pounds and I had a horrible vitamin D deficiency.
Wow.
And I started eating ribeyes after that. So I'm good now. Good to go.
I'm really sorry to hear that. I see that a lot. So whenever I share with people my experience, and I try to give people whatever their experience is, because diet is, it's a really tough topic for a lot of people. And people are really mean to me a lot. So they'll call me stupid. They'll call me just all kinds of names whenever I put myself out there and I just share my experience, and I'm not promoting one diet or another. I just say, here's my experience. Here's what I've seen in clinical practice. I've treated over 100,000 people. Probably way more than that, even. I would have to do the math. But as a practitioner, part of what gives us our skill set is to pick up on patterns. I think that's what we do too in the conspiracy world, is we're good at pattern recognition. So if you're a good practitioner, you'll have a good spidey sense. You'll develop your skill set based on what you've seen clinically. And when I share that experience, people are just so mad and mean. And it's comes from people who are in the medical system, outside the medical system, colleagues. I mean, you name it, you just have to be really careful, because if you're not leaning in the way that they're perception or their whatever's running their subconscious is in agreement with, they get really angry and really mean. And so I would be so curious to know why you chose to do that, Adam.
Well, I was eating really unhealthy. I have a history, like Todd, of drug and alcohol abuse. I'm sober now. And I've always, everybody in my family, we eat really fast, and I think I overeat, and I've never been fat or obese or anything like that, but I a lot of the time I leave the dinner table and I would feel like gross, you know, bloated, like I ate too much. And, I'm a huge fan of the hardcore band called the Cro-Mags. Their lead singer, John Joseph, who was actually on our show about a month ago, he's wide awake, but he is like a Ironman triathlete, just like Superman. But he doesn't call himself vegan because he doesn't like vegans, but he's plant-based and he preaches it really heavily. It works out for him really, really well. And, you know, I read his book. He's got a book called Meat is for Pussies. I read it and I was just like, okay, I'm going to give this a shot. And I kind of became annoyingly evangelical about it, you know, for the first 6 months, and then started questioning myself. And then I think I was listening to Joe Rogan a lot at that time. And I heard I wasn't feeling good. I had you know, I'd just been to the doctor and I was sick and I was pale and I was really, really small. And I heard Chris Kresser on Joe Rogan and he talks about the paleo cure. And I you know, that was enough to sway me back. And then I had like two or three other friends that had kind of gotten into it. We'd all kind of gotten into plant-based independently from each other at the exact same time. And then we had all, like, we're waiting for the other ones to like give in first before we could go back. So, and they all did. So
Well, I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you figured it out.
Yeah.
And you bring up a good point too, because that's what makes being a dietitian really difficult, because we all have an individual biochemistry. So, you know, your friend may do the athlete, the Ironman triathlete. They may do really well on a plant-based diet. For me, that would probably honestly kill me. I would not do well on that at all.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting as a practitioner to see how people will respond differently to different macro compositions. It's really, really, really hard to pin down for practitioners. Yeah. So that's why we should have an open mind.
Just back to that Seventh-day Adventist thing again. Have you ever heard of this movie called The Road to Wellville?
I haven't.
I've heard of it.
So I remember it coming out, and it's like, it's kind of a weird comedy about the Kellogg Sanatorium, and it has Ferris Bueller and John Cusack and Bridget Fonda and Anthony Hopkins in it. It came out in 94.
It's been on my list for a long time because I knew the topic it was about, but I've never seen it.
Yeah,
I'll have to check that out. Yeah. That's some big actors, and I feel like they tell us things through movies, so
yeah,
it would be interesting to see what we could learn from that movie,
whether it promotes it or yeah, it'd be interesting. I'll check it out too.
So there was, if we could talk a little bit maybe about Ansel Keys and his seven countries study.
Sure. So Ansel Keys was doing his research in the 50s and 60s, and he actually was an eel physiologist, which is funny because he ended up at the University of Minnesota. So I don't know how that happened, but he started doing... Eisenhower had a heart attack, and at the time he had already done some research and trying to, so at the time a lot of heart attacks were happening,
and our current president Eisenhower had a heart attack in office, right?
Yeah, as I understand it. Yep. Mm-hmm. So he got really interested in, I mean, that's so the story goes, right?
Yeah,
so I question everything now. I don't know if anything's real anymore, but so the story goes that he had a heart attack during his presidency, and Ansel Keys had been doing some of the research on trying to get to the root cause of heart attacks. And so he looked at 21 or 22 countries, and then he associated, so he was really looking at diet as a variable. They didn't look at other variables. I think they tried to control for most of the variables, which is another weakness in nutrition epidemiology, is almost impossible to do that, but they tried to tease out diet as the main variable. And then they associated it with heart attacks, cardiovascular disease. And so he cherry picked all of his data, and there were some countries in the study that he looked at. So I think Argentina was one of them, and maybe Japan. There were a few of the studies that showed that countries eating really high amounts of saturated fats that come from meat, they had really low risks or low rates of cardiovascular disease and heart attacks.
France as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. France was one of them.
It is interesting because you said 22 or whatever countries, but the study is called the Seven Countries Study, because that's what he ended up presenting, was just the evidence from seven of the countries that he actually looked into.
That's correct. Yeah. So that would be a really unethical thing to do. And when I first heard about this, I just thought, oh, it must have been the time period. That's why he got away with it. But there's a story to everything. And there is, from my observation, and I think the recent events that happened starting in 2019, I think that really shows that the science has been compromised for a very long time. And I thought nutrition was a special case. I thought that's why we have so much metabolic disease. We have so many issues that we can't get to the root to, because we can't study it well. It's a really, really hard thing to study. And that Ansel Keys set the stage. He's like the villain and the monster of nutrition, because we kind of blame everything on him, because we can't undo this bad science now, because I mentioned the PSYOP before, and I'm sure Deborah, you remember, I'm not sure what year you were born, but I have a lot of patients.
Born in 1929 during the
You're looking good, Deborah.
Don't I?
Yeah, so I think there are, so my mom's generation, even my grandma's generation, they used Crisco, but they thought fat was bad. So they were always like, my mom would, you know, when she was in grad school, she's like, I was the thinnest I ever was. And I would jog all the time and eat salads. So there was this thing about doing like long sessions of cardio workouts and eating a low fat diet. And so that will put anybody into metabolic disease. So I'm an insulin resistant. So I see that every day in my patient population.
Diabetes?
If we could describe, tell people what insulin resistance is. And then if I could say it as a layman, the way I understand it is that if you are, your body has to produce insulin when you eat certain foods or anything. And then if you're producing so much insulin all the time, then your cells become used to that insulin. And then you need to make more insulin, kind of like drugs, right? Or antibiotics. So if you do some Coke and you do it all the time, then you need more to actually get high. It's like you need more and more insulin to cover that same basis. Okay. And then you become resistant to that insulin.
It all makes sense now. Thank you, Lonnie.
Yeah. Is that a way to, did I do okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Yep. Perfect description of what insulin resistance is. And so another thing that's happening with the picture of insulin resistance is people are losing muscle because we're sedentary. So the loss of muscle mass is called sarcopenia as we age. So we're losing muscle mass, we're gaining fat mass. So sarcopenia is supposed to be a disease of aging, but we're seeing it now starting really young. So it's the perfect storm right now, setting us up to be insulin resistant. So I don't even know what the statistics are. I think most people go like I was, they're running around insulin resistant. They don't know it. So it would be an exception if I would see somebody who's in their 30s, starting at 30, who's not insulin resistant to some degree, unfortunately. And there was a recent study that came out. I want to say it was in 2018, and it talking about metabolic syndrome, and it showed that only 12% of the population is metabolically healthy. So they looked at triglycerides, glucose, hypertension, the need for pharmaceutical drugs. There was one, and I think waist circumference. So I think they looked at five measures, and only 12% of the population met the criteria for metabolic health based on those markers, which is really, really astounding. It's not to me because I see it every day, but when you think about only 12% of the population has good metabolic health, it's really sad. So we from the field of dietetics and nutrition, we're not doing well, right? We keep prescribing this diet, we're not doing well, people are getting sicker.
Yeah. So if you think like insulin, a lot of people don't know what it does, right? But insulin helps you store fat. So if you have elevated insulin, then you're continuing to store fat. And like one of the first symptoms that you'll see with somebody with type 1 diabetes is to lose a lot of weight and being urinating frequently, right? And that's from a lack of insulin. So if you have insulin all the time and you need more, your body produces more and more and more, then that's also contributing to then weight gain, right?
Yeah. So insulin, it's an anti-catabolic hormone, just like you're saying. So, catabolism is the breakdown of a molecule. So you're breaking down amino acids and fat. That's called lipolysis. So you're using stored fat, you're using glycogen. Glycogen is the stored form of sugar mm-hmm. in the body. Insulin is really, really anti-catabolic. So it prevents you from using anything that's stored. And if you think about it from like a primal point of view, fruit is like the best example of how insulin works, because fruit, when would human beings be drawn to, if you think about it from, like I said, a primal point of view, when would a human being, let's say that we were living in a society where we didn't have any manufactured foods, when would we go and eat a fruit? Like what time of the year? And this is where the
summertime. Yeah, summertime.
Right. So because why would we seek out fruit in the summertime?
Because it's available.
Right. It's available and it's ripe. So it would taste the sweetest at that time. So our drive for sweetness is what drives us to that food at that certain time of the year. So that's why you use circadian perspectives and the things that I do, because that kind of takes out the good food, bad food aspect, because timing is really important. So one of the things that fruit contains is fructose. Okay. So fructose, there's so much literature on this, and so much, it makes so much sense when you think of it, but I didn't learn this until after I came out of school, that fructose is really what's driving the hepatic insulin to go up and to be resistant. And that's not an accident from our creator. So we really, in the summertime, when there was a food scarcity, if we could fill up on fruit and drive our insulin levels up, that would be a really good way for us to store fuel to get through the winter time when food was more scarce. So when people are eating a plant-based diet and they're eating large amounts of fruit all year and they're thinking they're doing something healthy for themselves, that's where I'm like, okay, well, there's so many caveats to this. And if you are eating a local available fruit in the summertime and you're getting sunlight and it's matched, sort of like quantumly matched to your environment with what you're doing, and you're synced in your circadian rhythms, then yeah, it could be a healthy thing. But if you're eating, I think I said last time on the, if you're eating a banana in New Hampshire where I live in January, why would that be a healthy choice? You know, if you're looking at it from a metabolic perspective, and if you understand what the molecule fructose will do to your hormones. So we have to remember that food is information coming in, and then our body reacts to the stimulus in a way by creating hormones and neurotransmitters, right? And these are chemical messengers in the body that start a cascade of all of the things and the you know, setting this circle of motion, the human physiology in a broader aspect. So that's why when we have this diet prescription or just like plant-based, meat-based, whatever it is, it's not going to really get you to health.
Hmm. And what does the fructose do to the hormones?
So the fructose specifically acts in the liver. And so when your liver becomes resistant to insulin, then that kind of sets the stage for like what Lonnie was saying about fat accumulation and the anti-catabolic piece. So that's when the resistance really, so if you have fructose, chronic exposure to fructose in your body every day, some people believe it starts in the liver, because you have there's different cells in the body that will become insulin resistant. And some people think that first it happens in the liver and then it will go into the peripheral system, like the muscles. But it really, so when you look at fatty liver disease, I'm sure you've heard of that. That's a huge problem now in America. So a lot of people are running around, even really thin people, like Adam, I'm thinking of you. You may have had fatty liver disease when you were on the plant-based diet.
I got diagnosed with it, like being pre-fatty liver, I think almost 2 years ago. And I was eating a lot of just like candy, like refined sugar and stuff, and I cut that out, and I think I might have straightened it out. But yeah, so it's crazy that you did that
right on the nose.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, it's the pattern recognition. So that's why it's so hard to sit back and watch this happen, because now they're really, really pushing that from the economic forum. They're really pushing the plant-based diet really heavily now. And I see more and more that people are gravitating towards it and doing it in the schools. And now the policies are being shaped by this. And so we'll see fatty liver, we'll see metabolic disease. When I was working in outpatient oncology, I saw a lot of vegans and vegetarians with cancer. So they think it's protective from a cancer standpoint. I think it is, the plant-based diet is better than, it's like you were doing, Adam, like if your baseline diet is really, really poor, like the chicken nuggets, processed food, the plant-based diet will be better. And when you look at the nutrition research, that's always what they're measuring.
Yeah, okay. But you can also call yourself plant-based or vegan, and you can eat like Oreos and French fries too. So,
right.
Yeah. So it's like if you're comparing a healthy vegan diet to the standard American diet of poison garbage, then it's better. Yeah. And you might feel better when you make that switch.
To make it work, you need to really, really get your supplements down and do it the right way. And I don't think that most people can make the change and not eat meat for a while, even though it sucks. But I don't think 90% of the people that are doing it in a healthy manner. And I think that's probably the if you can't even do it in a healthy manner for a broad spectrum of people. Maybe there's just a few different kinds of people that it'll actually work for. But I was going to ask you if you knew, I can't remember if it was in like Forks Over Knives when that movie came out and was all the rage. Do you know anything about that Chinese vegan study that they did? Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah. So the China study, I know that Forks Over Knives was based on that, but it was just more epidemiology. So when I say epidemiology, like I said, it's looking at really large groups of people over a long period of time, usually in retrospect. So you look back and then you make associations and the variables and these outcomes. So in the China study, it just showed that like less meat eating had better cancer outcomes, better cardiovascular longevity was better. But Chris Kresser was really good about talking about this. I learned from him something called the healthy user bias. So people who tend to go on a plant-based diet would also not be, they would be like Seventh-day Adventists. They would be more obedient. They would get sleep better. They would usually abstain from alcohol. They would do a lot of things, exercise, right? So the same people that are, you know, participating in those healthier behaviors are more probably likely to go on a plant-based diet than the guy who's grilling burgers and drinking beer and smoking a cigarette at the football tailgate, right? So, and it's really, really hard to tease out those variables when you do epidemiology. So really you're just studying the healthy user bias when these studies are published.
Yeah. I remember like hearing Chris Presser talk, and he would talk about when you would compare like a plant-based person to someone who's eating a traditional like American diet, like how it's causing more cancer or more disease, but they don't factor in like if you're eating a hamburger, they don't factor in like that you're eating French fries, a hamburger bun, and a hot fudge sundae with it too, you know? So yeah, that makes sense that it's like a more a dedicated person who would, or a religious person who would adhere to that, and it would be called a healthier diet.
Yeah. And I think too, like, I think protein, there's a guy named Ted Naiman. He's up in, are you guys in Washington? Lanny's
in Washington. I'm in Northwest Oregon.
I'm in, yeah, Washington State.
Okay. So there's a guy up there named Ted Naiman. He's a primary care doctor, and he created this, sort of like movement called the protein leverage hypothesis. So he believes if you meet your protein needs, you can leverage the other macronutrients, but everybody should be meeting their protein needs. And that's what I see. I see that every day in clinical practice. I see it when I go out of my house and I look around at people, because I'm trained to assess body composition. So whenever I look at someone, I'm always assessing body composition because of my training. So, I think Ted Naiman really has it right. I think if you can get people to meet their protein needs, I think it doesn't matter as much what else they're eating on the periphery, as long as they're meeting their protein needs. Because when you do that, you're getting a lot of the minerals that you need, and you're satiated, you're satisfied. So you're not eating a lot of the garbage. And so these are all of the reasons why nutrition can get tricky, because if you're not satiated, if you're not satisfied, if you're not meeting your protein needs, you will be eating other things that are not nutrients for your body. And then you will see the hormone cascades taking place. So it's just this vicious cycle. And protein, I think, is one of the things that we can leverage to pull people out of that cycle. And if protein and meat are being limited, it's a huge concern of mine. I think if we're sick now, I think we would see a lot more metabolic illness, every illness across the board, if they start limiting our access to high biological value proteins from animals.
Hey, Deborah, have you heard anything about in your circles about limiting meat consumption or cutting down?
Yeah.
And like impossible burgers and
yeah,
stuff like
and there's
that.
All sorts of different reasons, because you know, cows make methane gas and they need a lot of water. Stuff
and it's
like that.
All,
so
it's framed in a positive light.
Exactly.
So are you hearing it in the media as well as amongst like your friend,
so.
Your friend, how about amongst your friend and family circles?
I don't know where I heard it, but
yeah,
I get, it must've been media.
Yeah. Have you heard about eating bugs?
Oh yeah, I will. Yeah,
it might be better than being vegan though.
Yeah,
the crickets.
What? So if you're, I'm not saying that, you know, we all need to eat a pure protein diet, but for those like you who are, and it's working for you, how do you get the other vitamins and minerals that fruits and vegetables provide?
So actually meat is a really, really great source of minerals. So there's more potassium in most meats and fish than there is in, I feel like an ounce for ounce than there is in something like a tomato. So I track my nutrients because I have a really hard time with potassium, and I need a lot of potassium because I've been breastfeeding for 4.5 years. Yeah. So I've had 3 babies in the last, since 2017, I've done nothing but have babies, be pregnant and nurse babies. So I think when I looked it up last time, a woman every day will put out like 500, milligrams of potassium in their breast milk for the baby. So we lose 500 milligrams every day. Now we need about the RDA. If you believe that, trust the RDA, it says we need 4,700 milligrams a day. It's almost impossible to do that. I don't know anybody that's really meeting their potassium needs, even when they're on a vegan vegetarian diet or just a standard American diet. It's really hard to do. So I do mine with mostly meat. I eat a lot of avocado, and I try to include a lot of tomatoes in my diet, or V8 juice. Even V8 juice might be manufactured garbage, but at least I'm meeting my potassium needs. And I also take Element packets. Rob Wolf makes them. They've got I need a lot of sodium because I'm nursing, and so they've got sodium and potassium in there. So I think if you're eating any diet these days, a supplement is necessary for pretty much 100% of the population across the board. It's really hard to get away without taking any supplements. So that was a really good question. That's why it's a little bit tricky to recommend these diets, because there's a lot of nuances, right. And you have to really pin things down, especially the contexts are different. So for me, I exercise a lot. I'm nursing the babies. I'm a woman at a certain age, so that would be a totally different diet prescription or concern than somebody who is in their 20s and playing football in college and is a male, you know.
When I was pregnant with my children, I always got muscle cramps in my calf, Charlie horses.
Yeah.
Always. And I would just wake up and eat a banana and think, okay, that's it. That's all I need.
I had that really bad in my first pregnancy, but then this last one, now eating a paleo diet, and I was very careful that I didn't have any muscle cramps at all.
I used to get those when I was hungover in bed all the time. I'd wake up and my calves would that be too. Cramped up.
That was unrelated to my first pregnancy. Those were separate.
Thank God.
But I too am nursing, and I didn't actually know that about the increased potassium. You know, I mean, I eat well anyway, and I feel good, but that's good. I should focus on that. Have you heard of people using cream of tartar to supplement potassium?
I have heard that. Yeah. I'm not sure how much is in there, and I'm really careful with acid base too, because I've made, like, when I say I've made the mistakes in my life with dieting, just trying to feel better, I've made them all. So I've done supplements for myself. I don't recommend supplements to most of my clients, just because, number one, dietitians, it's crazy. Our liability insurance doesn't cover supplements for us. So if we recommend a supplement or someone says a supplement harm them, we are not covered by our liability insurance. And it's really, really, supplements are super tricky. So people like Chris Kresser, who is doing it, they really, really know their stuff. And they're constantly sort of moving the pieces of the puzzle so they fit together well. But cream of tartar, yeah, I wouldn't be sure how much that you would need to take or other things to watch out for. Have you read anything more about that?
Oh, yeah, I was looking into it because my blood pressure was creeping up a little bit towards the end of my last pregnancy, and I was working towards a home birth, and it was important to stay within a certain range so that the midwife would feel comfortable having me at home. And I found online in a home birth community, they had recommended that, but along with real salt. So the sodium being in balance as well, and then magnesium. So I was taking magnesium supplements, a couple different types, as well as trace mineral drops in my water, and then real salt. I would take real salt and whole food vitamin C and cream of tartar, and that helped it. So I was able to stay within a healthy range for my pregnancy and deliver at home.
Awesome. I'm so glad you figured that out. Yeah, it can be so tricky. And sodium is another big thing that's been demonized. And I think, so if you don't get enough sodium in your diet, you will become insulin resistant also. So sodium will help your kidneys retain water. And that was something that we were taught to, you know, we're always prescribing low sodium diets. So you're back into that insulin resistance cycle again. So when insulin levels drop lower, so if anybody goes on a lower carbohydrate diet, they get cramps, like you were saying, Adam. Sodium is a huge, huge player in the water retention. So if you don't have a lot of circulating insulin on board, so I probably eat like, I would say 5 or 6 grams of sodium a day. And I think the RDA is, it's 2300 is the latest recommendation for sodium. So I eat at least double that, maybe triple on some days if I'm exercising. And when I don't, I get in real trouble. So I'm really sensitive to not having salt because I don't have a lot of circulating insulin anymore because I fixed my diet. So insulin and carbohydrates will act on the kidneys to make you retain water. And then it will, insulin will create a spike in blood pressure. So a lot of pregnant women, because of the placental hormones, will experience high blood pressure. A lot of it has to do with that insulin piece.
Yeah, it was really, really important the second pregnancy for me to be really careful with, I mean, even vegetables, but I didn't eat any grain or any sugar or any vegetable oil. And I kept my weight gain to 10 pounds, just that what came in the last month, which was gone after the baby was here. So it was hard at first to make the switch when I didn't feel good. You know, protein doesn't really sound good to a pregnant lady the first trimester a lot of the time, but it was really worth it. And I felt so much better. And my history with diet too is just like everyone else here, being a kid child of the 80s and early 90s and a mom who was her kind of yo-yo diet. So like Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, all of the things. Yeah. I was in Weight Watchers when I was like 11 or 12 with her to learn how to eat healthy because I was a big kid. And I just had the backwards, so backwards. And it wasn't until after my first child had an anaphylactic response to peanuts and I started to really dig into what is in food. And I kind of found my way to the Whole30 diet. One way or another, which is a paleo diet and an elimination diet. So you remove all grain, sugar, vegetable oils, and preservatives, and then add things back one at a time and watch how you feel. And that's really where I started to build my diet of feeling better. And during that time too, I was also diagnosed with pre-diabetes, you know, the high fasting blood sugars, and, you know, being overweight my whole life, I would lose and gain the same 50 pounds over and over again. And it was really, wasn't until I understood that processed carbohydrates don't make me feel good. It's not right for me. But then really the circadian rhythm that you speak about, like eating seasonally and understanding that there's certain times where I can enjoy a lot of fresh fruits and other things that are sweet. And then there's other times where that's not the healthiest thing for me. So while my weight is still higher than I'd like it to be, I'm no longer pre-diabetic and I no longer have.
Lanny froze up.
High blood pressure. And I think I was on a roll.
Yeah, you're on a roll.
Got me back.
You're back.
Okay.
So you're no longer pre-diabetic.
Nope. And my blood pressure is under control without any needing to do anything. And I was originally put on high blood pressure medication when I was only 22 and I wasn't And that was when I was really trying my hardest to be really low calorie, low fat, you know, walking every day. And I was sick and I didn't feel good and mentally didn't feel good and didn't have good energy. And it took me a long time to get through all of the garbage because I already thought I was so well studied on diet, nutrition, that I didn't understand that everything that had been taught to me previously had an agenda. And it was, you know, based on studies that were funded by big giant companies that wanted you to buy their products. That Weight Watchers was based on the dietary recommendations for diabetics. That was based on the information that came funded by the sugar industry. And the Heart Association isn't actually trying to make you healthy. They're trying to sell whole grains. So it's, there's a lot of junk to like wade through to be able to get to where you, well, think about nature and God and the way the earth is, and eat what's in season and eat what makes you feel good, and think about how it makes you feel, not how it's supposed to make you feel, you know. Healthy yeah. food doesn't have to taste bad and be a, like a punishment. You know, if you're thin and on a diet, it doesn't mean that your food has to taste bad.
Yeah. I loved what you said about all the connections there with all the companies. And I think it, I think people always go back to money. It's always about money. It's more, much more than money. It's really a, it's a ritualistic thing. I think they're trying to, it's like a parasitic thing. I think they're trying to make us weak, because, you know, I was as a sick person my entire life, you don't know what it's like to feel good. And then when you do, it really, really opens your mind. You can think again, you can perform physically, mentally, your emotions come back into, you can use your emotions in your favor. And spiritually.
You're not reliant on the government or some other entity that's going to, is that your stomach growling? Is your
dog? That's my dog. He's laying at my feet going.
That sounds like a pit bull snore.
That is so funny. It is.
The timing was so perfect there too. Yeah. So it's like this really predatory, like, I feel like things were mapped out a really long time ago, that they have some sort of information that we don't have. And I think that everything's kind of pre-planned, like a simulation type of setup. That's what I my current wacky conspiratorial belief is, because all these pieces of the puzzle fit together so well. And when you look at, I was reading the other day about iron fortification. This is wild. So they started fortifying our food supply with iron during the Industrial Revolution, probably because they needed some place to put the iron.
Yeah, there's all the metal byproducts, the rust and all that stuff they need to get rid of. Like,
so they recycle all their garbage back into us. Like, and you look at the plastics and the nanos and all that stuff. It's all
sell it to us too.
It's they how do. They fluoride ended up in our water and our toothpaste and all that shit. After they started mass producing aluminum and scraping it out of the chimneys of the smokestacks of aluminum factories.
Yeah, it's really crazy when I really started to learn more about that when I started learning about Tartaria. I'm sure you guys have heard of that.
That's all we talk about pretty much. So.
Yeah, so I feel like it takes kind of one thing for people to get red pilled. Deborah, I haven't heard how they red pilled you.
But it's an ongoing process.
It's continuing.
Yeah, I mentioned something to my mom last time she was here, and she asked me if I was suicidal. And I was like, no, and like when I was talking to her, I was like, doesn't everybody think like I do?
Yeah,
I know.
Clearly not.
No.
What were you talking about?
I don't even remember. I think I was talking about probably something about the simulation that we live in, or it's not what you think it is, Mom. And she's very, very Catholic.
I do this with Deborah, because if I tried to do it with, I don't want to get written out of the will, you know what I mean? So.
And I'm happy to be here today with Deborah too, because I also have an Italian Catholic mother that is just not, she's like, I know things are probably bad, but I don't want to think about it. That's it. Okay. I'm like, well, there's spring chemtrails over your house again. Have a nice day.
I know.
It's poison. Curious, Katie, have you heard of the Dr. Jason Fung, of his work?
Yeah, I actually, I was just corresponding. So there's a group of people who practice using low carb, and we're all in a group together, and we email back and forth with patient cases and stuff. We ask each other for help. So I was just asking for help with some of my, I have a lot of patients who have congestive heart failure. So I was going on and asking this group of physicians and dietitians, pharmacists about their approach for congestive heart failure and what the literature was showing. And he had a really good response. He was really helpful for one of my questions that I had. He's a super smart guy. So he does the fasting.
Yeah, intermittent fasting, yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of, so my opinion and my sort of perspective on fasting is that fasting is a circadian thing. It's something that humans were meant to do. We weren't supposed to be eating all day, every day. So now that we're not doing that, they call it fasting. So it's really just a physiologic thing. That's a natural human thing that we just need to go through periods of not eating. It should be sort of this cycle.
If you break down the first meal of the day into two words, what is it?
Right, exactly.
And you don't have to break your fast. And it's the most
important meal of the day.
That was that marketing. That was
drummed into our heads. Yeah.
Well, because that comes from Kellogg.
Yeah.
Cereal. You got to have your cereal, you know.
And then have a half a grapefruit with some sugar sprinkled on it, too.
Because Edward Bernays did nail. The one thing I'm happy that he got us doing was eating eggs and bacon for breakfast.
Bacon and eggs. But you can have bacon and eggs at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, I do it all the time.
8 a.m., right?
Yeah, I've got a pig in the freezer and an unlimited supply of eggs all day, every day. So
do it. Yeah,
I think I ate like 8 eggs today. I eat a lot of eggs because I'm big on like the Irish Catholic in me is still somewhat cheap. Pathologically cheap. So I like to see if I can meet my protein needs by not spending a lot of money. And so an egg, I think, is like 25 cents an egg. Now it might be like 28 cents. But pound per pound, you're getting so much nutrition for a really low amount of money. So I do tons of eggs every day. My kids eat a lot of eggs and we're all really healthy.
And what about, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that they were telling us to limit our eggs.
Or just eat egg whites and throw away the yolk where all the nutrition is.
No,
right?
Remember egg? Do you guys remember egg beaters?
Yeah,
my Weight Watchers days. It was 0 points until you got to a certain cup, and you know, measuring that out.
Yeah,
and not making omelets with it, fake cheese.
So my dad was so unhealthy and stressed out that he had quadruple bypass heart surgery when he was 45 years old.
Wow.
I was 9. It was super scary. That's 3 years older than me right now. And he wasn't like a big fat obese guy. He probably had a beer gut. You know, he drank like a lot of Budweiser's and like he was a sales rep for a hospital supply company. So he was just on the road, like chewing sunflower seeds all day. He'd smoked pretty heavily, but had quit. And then he was just like, I think eating at drive-throughs and stuff like that. And it was like the late 80s and he had a lot of money tied up in the stock market and was super stressed out all the time, you know. And man, I look at pictures of him back then, and man, his head was just like, his face was like bright red, and it's crazy to think of that just a couple years older than me. I don't think I'm anywhere near needing that, you know.
And after his surgery, was that like egg beaters and that kind of diet?
What egg beaters, what white chicken, a lot of iceberg lettuce.
Believe it's not butter.
It was the late 80s, early 90s. It was all the low fat stuff, like remember Molly McButter? Do you ever remember that? All that stuff, when they say that there's no fat in it, it just means they replace the taste that fat gives it with sugar.
They put plastic, it's a petroleum product they're putting in there, so they're taking, you know, it's not butter, but it's a manufactured like canola oil. If you just watch the videos and you see how they're manufactured, it's just like, it's like they're mocking us, really. I really believe that they're making these really, really toxic, poisonous.
Yeah. It's like they're daring each other. Like, dude, I bet you I can get them to do the,
and we do it.
Yeah. I bet you I can get them to eat, plastic. I'll one up you. I'll sell this aluminum byproduct and say it's good for your teeth.
So your dad is what I deal with every day on the clinical side. That's the patient that I have every day. So I'm trying to make them unlearn all of this PSYOP that they've learned. And I'm like, just eat bacon and eggs for breakfast and don't eat Cheerios. And they're like, what? I can't.
Yeah,
I have high cholesterol.
So, that's
like,
so hard for people to get in their head.
But they do it. They do it because it's good. So
and then
I'm not
they feel better.
Them.
And there's your evidence, you know?
Yeah. So they do it and it's so awesome. And then thank God I have a really, really great supportive medical team. So I've been in situations where my coworkers have been think I'm this loony and I'm hurting people. My team now, my doctors, my nurse practitioner, everybody that I work with, they're all super on board, and they email me and they're like, can you give me a diet too? They're like, they're all metabolically sick themselves. Like, can you? And I'm like, sure, absolutely. And then they love it. They all feel better. They're satiated. They're satisfied. I'm in such a, so grateful for the position I'm in now to be able to really have an impact and to help these guys like your dad, kind of unlearn. And we don't want to be eating these tasteless, you know, garbage diets. I mean, that's like a miserable way to live. You know, it's just so sad that the people are choosing to eat this way when all they have to eat, you know.
Yeah. How do you determine that you are metabolically challenged?
So there's a number of ways. So like I said, that one study that I mentioned was really good. I think it was done by the University of North Carolina. And I want to say 2018, I don't remember the title of the study, but you can look at blood pressure. You can measure your circulating insulin levels. So if you can do a fasting test, you can measure your insulin. You can measure, just start with glucose. I tell everyone, I'm like, if you're curious about how you're responding to food, since we all respond differently, just go to Walmart and buy a glucose meter and just eat the normal food that you would eat. And 1 hour after you take your first bite of food from that meat, whatever meal, 1 hour later, take your blood sugar and see what it is. You can learn so much about your individual biochemistry by doing that. So I do it with me and my husband sometimes, and it's so funny to see how different he is compared to me. So I have a very, very low tolerance for any carbohydrates. And anytime that I eat like tortilla chips are really bad for me. Like I'll go high and then I'll stay high like for really, really, it'll take hours. Like this one time I just like went for it at a Mexican restaurant, and my blood sugar stayed elevated for like 5 hours, and I felt bloated and sick. And just, I mean, there's hormones in the gut called incretin hormones. And so a lot of the pharmaceutical drugs they're making now are incretin mimetics, they're called. So they mimic incretin hormones, and they work really well to bring people's blood sugars down. They don't need the drug. All they need to do is just take out the carbohydrates. And all you need to show you what foods to eliminate or to, you know, cut back on is a glucose meter. Anybody can do it. So that would be one really good way, Deborah, is to have your own glucose meter and do what's called a 1 hour postprandial glucose test. Another way is like have your doctor check your insulin, your triglycerides should be.
You're probably already getting a blood draw once a year at the doctor.
I am. Right? I did recently, and I looked at everything, you know, listed, and you know, it didn't mean much to me because.
Yeah. What does it mean? But you're an A1C or your fasting blood sugar level is what you're looking for to see.
Right? Yeah. And triglycerides, like I said, like it's cholesterol is pretty tricky because there's a lot of studies showing that the higher your cholesterol is, especially with aging, it's protective against cancers, and dementia are the two big ones. So it's not really great for everyone to have a cholesterol level below 200. So, but if you do, your doctor will offer you a statin usually. And I'm not an expert on this topic by any means, but all of my patients are on a statin drug, like every single one of them. I know my parents are, both of my parents are, because they hit that 200 mark. So there's a lot of really good information out there on statin drugs. And I don't have a feeling one way or another about them just because I'm not an expert on it. But it's just another, you just want to have more, you know, just because you have a certain blood level of anything, it doesn't mean that you need a pharmaceutical drug.
And I mean, there is a lot of studies out there with the statins showing that people on statins have a higher likelihood of having a heart attack. So the numbers actually are not good for those medicines. And I tell my parents to stop taking the statins, and they don't listen to me. And my dad just had a episode and had two stents put in. So, and you know, I'm fortunate the nutritionist he talked to did tell him to eat eggs. He's like, can you believe it? All these years they're telling me not to eat eggs, and I do anyway. And now they're telling me to eat eggs. I'm like, so he's probably going to stop eating eggs and eat something else, because he's like me and he's just a, you know, do the opposite kind of a thing. But yeah, it's true. It's interesting to see some of the dietitians and some people start to wake up and start to speak out. But I wonder if you're familiar with a Dr. Noakes out of South Africa and his work in the low carb community. He was recently on trial for putting his patients on low carbohydrate diets. Maybe this was a couple of years ago. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah. So Dr. Noakes, I've like rubbed elbows with at a few of the conferences too. It's a pretty small community. So the people in the low carb world, we all know each other. It sounds so
have you ever been on the low carb cruise?
I haven't. No, I haven't because I've been pregnant and having babies for 5 years. So I haven't done anything other than
a vacation. Yeah.
Put my breast in my baby's mouth for 10 hours a day for five years. It's a really, and I will say this too about any community, it can become a religion and a dogma. So mm-hmm. I've seen that happen in the low carb world, and I'm always kind of like, and I was that way at one time myself, just because it's opposite of what we've been trained to do. And if you have that personality, you want to rebel against mm-hmm. the system. If you've been sick, if you've, you know, it sucks being a practitioner in the traditional system now, because everyone's sick all the time. And it's just so hard every day to see what we see. And so you want to rebel and you want to be sort of like the savior, the answer, but it's not a cure all for everyone. It's not meant for everyone. And it can get pretty religious in any dieting. So I was, now that I'm on the other side of the religious piece, I just always kind of throw that out there too, that it can get pretty religious too.
Yeah.
I've made that mistake.
The Dr. Noakes trial though was really interesting, because in South Africa it is not okay that any dietitian or doctor gives information to patients that would be different than their government guidelines. Is that right?
Yeah. And that it's pretty similar here too. So you have to, anytime you give information, it has to be pretty heavily supported by consensus guidelines. So they're all consensus guidelines. Consensus guidelines are industrial marketing campaigns is what they are, but they call them consensus guidelines. And the people that are who, like dietitians or doctors, who get really upset about like you're not following the guidelines, they're really, really brainwashed. They're really brainwashed. So you really should be individualizing patient care. It should be patient-centered care, but it's if you're in the wrong healthcare system, you're going to have to be a robot, and you're going to just have to follow guidelines. No thinking is allowed. No diet individualization is allowed at all. You just have to.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that with the problem with the air the past 2 years, you know, mm-hmm. I mean,
that's what's scary when anything becomes, you know, a government law, a rule, is then if there's new information that comes out and they don't accept that, or you can't explore alternatives on your own and find an expert to help you with that, it's really concerning.
I'm going to just flip a light on. Just give me a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think, Deborah?
I think I eat pretty healthy and,
You're pretty healthy for
an 80-year-old.
Yeah. You're pretty healthy. You're strong.
I am strong. Yeah. But, I want to dig deeper.
What do you consider a healthy diet though? Cause, what do you kind of, what's your normal go-to kind of stuff, Deborah?
A balance of, you know, there's always some vegetable along with some protein, and, you know, we try to limit the carbs and limit the sugar, but.
And what's your perspective on fat? What do you think about fat in your diet?
Well, I know that we need a certain amount, but you know, I try to keep it within a limited. Mm-hmm. Has been, you know, that's the way that's everything I heard.
Yeah, that was the biggest, hardest change for me. Was to think that fat was okay to eat, and especially natural fats, because mm-hmm. even especially with Weight Watchers, which was most of my indoctrination at a young age, was healthy oils were like canola oil and soybean oil, olive oil, okay, And now that stuff doesn't come into my house except to help season my cast iron pans when I refinish them. And so, you know, olive oil and avocado oil, coconut oil are on the okay list, but animal fats are the best. And I'm rendering my own lard and my own tallow so that I can have that on hand. And from grass-fed animals, because the nutrient profile in meats and fats from animals that have been fed their natural diet is a different than your conventional feedlot animals as well. That part was the hardest thing for me to change. But once I did, like, eating fat and protein makes you feel full and feel full for longer and feel healthy.
Hey. Sorry, he just woke up and got out of bed. So he's going to, you just have to be quiet, but you can sit with us. Okay. This is Mikey.
Hey, Mikey. Hi.
How old is he?
He'll be 3 in August.
Oh, awesome.
Nice. Yeah. Big guy.
Yeah. So I think, this is, let's see, we skipped over a couple things. Oh, Dr. Jason Fung, he's known for his insulin hypothesis, as it's called, and he's got a ton of really good YouTube videos. He does a really good job explaining how insulin works in the body and what it's for, what its purpose is, and how it gets out of whack. And so I would encourage anybody to look those up if you're interested in learning more about that. And yeah, his idea of intermittent fasting is really not, like, people are like, oh, you're going to starve yourself and intermittent fasting is terrible. We're talking like 12 hours. We're talking 12 to 16 hours and you're asleep for 8 of those. So it's really not, just like you said, it's not anything more than just like normal. It's to just say, push your breakfast back by a couple hours. Don't feel like you need to make a smoothie before you leave the house to go to work, that eat when you're hungry. And that was the biggest change for me to reverse that high fasting and numbers on my blood sugar, was that I would just, you know, eat dinner and not eat after, and then not eat breakfast. And then lunch would come maybe by 2 o'clock whenever I got hungry. And I would be like 2 meals a day. And then my husband started to do that, you know, gradually, but he's a 1 meal a day guy. And he feels so much better with that as well. Just like better energy during the day, less brain fog, all of that. So he eats dinner whenever, you know, between 5 and 7, and that's his big meal. And maybe,
darn it, we lost you again.
Uh-oh.
He'll have a snack before bed, and that's how he feels. Am I really get? You got me back?
Yeah.
Got you back. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that everybody's different, and then just not being afraid, like the programming we've been had our whole life is to that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And that if you don't eat it, your body will go into starvation mode, and that you'll store fat, and that you need to, you know, eat that cereal in the morning to really kickstart your metabolism. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. So I would say with fasting too, one of the things that I figured out, and when I went on a low carb diet, like the most awesome part for me was that I wasn't hungry for the first time. So I was hungry my whole life. I was eating constantly, constantly, constantly eating. So, and there's another hypothesis about diabetes. Sit down, buddy. It's called the adipose tissue dysfunction model of diabetes. So that would be like the thinner diabetics who get insulin resistant. So we have to constantly eat and eat and eat because we're hungry. And so when I went on low carb, I just honestly, even nursing, like sometimes I'll just forget to eat. I'll be working, cleaning my house, doing all the things that I do. And my husband's like, he's Hispanic, so they want you to eat all the time. So he's like, did you eat today, babe? You know, he's always trying to feed me. And I'm like, he worries because it's a cultural thing. And I'm totally satisfied and fine. And my numbers, my metabolism and I reversed all of my metabolic disease. I'm super healthy, super strong. I'm performing mentally all the ways that I want to perform. I am really well. And I'm not hungry. And that's, I think, like the ideal diet, whatever that is for whoever it is, that's how you know you've kind of found your diet or your foods, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah. And it was a big deal to me too, that I continued intermittent fasting well through my pregnancy. And that was like, no, you should be eating more meals a day and smaller meals.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the very end when I was so big that I couldn't hold much food in at a time. So I would eat a couple extra smaller meals. But for the most part, I still did the same thing. I didn't have breakfast and didn't eat lunch until later in the day. And that's where I felt better. But it's just important then that you have really nutrient dense foods. You have real food, you have protein and fat in the meals that you do eat. And that carries you through. And it is different too. When you've been eating low carbohydrate, you don't get that like hungry, you know, in between your meals. So fasting is not a big deal.
Hey, Katie. So you've been successfully pregnant 3 times in the last 5 years, right?
Yep.
What diet do you recommend for women who are maybe having a hard time getting pregnant, who want to be desperately?
Yeah, so I've had some experience with that too. So there's a joke in the low carb world that it makes you super, super fertile. So if you go keto or low carb, be careful because you'll get pregnant.
I've heard that as well on the Joel Salatin's podcast.
Yeah. So, and I've even had like dietitian colleagues of mine, friends, reach out to me and for assistance. And I'm like, hey, just stop taking folic acid, take methylfolate. And they're like, I've never heard of that before. And it was take my methylfolate, not folic acid, and just stop eating fruit and grains and just see what happens. And every time they're like, that was so easy. So it's so sad because my sister actually went through infertility and it was a really, really difficult, very difficult thing. So, yeah, in every sucks. Way, it was so hard. So her and her husband tried for 5 years. They did have twins, but it was like $100,000 and lots of tears and just, I mean, it was a really difficult 5 years. And it doesn't have to be that way, right? It doesn't. I truly believe that if we could do just those two things that I just said, most women would probably, and if the man should do it too, because there's a huge issue now with sperm counts and sperm quality because of diet and all the things that the poisons that we're exposed to and the staying up late, the blue light, not, you know, all the things. If everybody could have better like health hygiene, the man too, we would see infertility rates. I mean, Kellogg's prescription was to reduce fertility rates, right? Yep. So we knew this. And then in the 1950s and the earlier, Kellogg was earlier than that. So they've been working on this reducing fertility rates for almost 100 years. So if we can do the opposite of what he taught, I think just personally, I've seen really great things. And clinically, there's a doctor down in Florida who runs a low carb fertility clinic. His name is, I want to say Michael Fox, maybe, I think his name is. I think he's in Tallahassee, if I remember right, but he has great success with that. And he doesn't put the women through all of the hormone shots and all that, you know?
Yeah. That's so wild when we think about it in relations to eugenicists and Kellogg's, and then like everything we've been told the past couple of years, which I believe is true too, about the medicine injections and eugenics and all that stuff. But it's like, look at what Kellogg started and processed boxed foods, and like walk into Walmart, see what's available on the shelves, and look at the people there buying it and be like, man, that's done more than some injections for infertility and eugenics than anything. It's just
when you think about it, it's crazy, right? That's why
controlling the food, man.
Yeah, it's crazy. If you think about like on a broad scale, it could, people who don't think like we think and are not red pilled yet, Deborah, they won't understand that. But it's, if you think about it, it is wild. It's wild. Yeah,
it's whole fast food industry is, you know, so many people just depend on fast food to fuel themselves. And I don't know if there's any controversial stuff behind that, making it so available everywhere.
Well, and even stepping back from that and thinking of the stuff that was promoted to, you know, housewives during the feminist movement, and when they were telling people to get back to work, and all these convenience products, and, you know, Swanson's TV dinners, and Betty Crocker, you know, box cake mix, and all of this stuff to make things convenient. Every time you take that back a little, you lose that skill of cooking and preparing food like naturally. And if you look at this, like the studies of Dr. Weston A. Price and the information he has there, and the traditional ways of preparing food actually helps you unlock the nutrients and them being more available to you, like soaking or sprouting grains and nuts and things like that. Like sourdough versus just conventional bread. And then all the additive that go into those products to make them so they're shelf stable, all of that is more of that poison being recycled through us, so that they, you know, dumping that into our foods and fortified as well, you know, vitamins and the other stuff.
Yeah.
Weston A. Price is great. So I tell people too, like, if you want to know if your health is if you have good health or a good, if your diet is healthy for you, look at your dental health. So I think if dietitians and doctors, if we could all see through the lens of a dentist, I think the diets would, prescriptions would change. Cause now it's this the diet heart hypothesis, everything is centered around that and that research from 100 years ago. But if we shifted it to a Western A Price, cause he was a dentist, right?
He was a dentist and he did studies on teeth and jaw shape and people that were on the indigenous, the natural diet for their area versus the diets that had been westernized. And he compared generations of the same tribes and found that people had broad, wide faces, beautiful skin, white teeth, and a big jaw arch. And then the next generation that had been eating a Western diet, and then further, if they had continued eating Western diet through pregnancy and then delivered the next generation, even more so, had very narrow jaw arches, or, you know, a dental arch, I think you would say, and their teeth were really crowded. And then you don't have room for your wisdom teeth. And you have just sinus to show issues you how, breathing.
How shitty the English diet is.
Right. The horrible teeth. And the fact that we don't have room for our wisdom teeth to come in anymore. That's not normal to have to take those out. That's something that's happened because of malnutrition, not getting the nutrition that we need and instead getting poisons as a replacer.
Well, and you talk about home births too. Like, that's so awesome. I was listening to your episode on the home births, and it's, there's no room for the baby to come down the birth canal anymore either. So we're having to do cesareans and all these barbaric, unnatural things. So the baby is traumatized before they, you know, even really get here.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. And so if anyone has time to look in, Weston A. Price Foundation has a lot of good resources, not only of diet recommendations of like eating food as naturally as possible, like raw milk, raw cheese, grass-fed animals, animal fats, and grains that have been sprouted or soaked, but in preparations for that. And they have recipes on their website, fermented foods, all the stuff that I'm super into. But they also... they have this really great resource guide. So if you donate to them, like even if it's $5 a year, they send you a guide, and it's got by state, all these different places where you can get these foods, because it is hard sometimes to say, just go and buy raw milk, depending on where you are, that could be even illegal. But to find local farmers that are supplying these foods and make connections with them in your community, that's the way for you to be able to not only have the healthy food now, but then to solidify that connection for these shortages that we may see coming, that you'll have access to those things that you need.
Yeah. And they have like meetups and presentations, and Allison Pillow, who was just on my show, she did a presentation for them in Portland. Cool. So yeah. Look into them. And yeah, I've used the raw milk finder before. It's kind of clunky, but it works. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess you got a restless little baby there, Katie. So we'll start getting you out of here. But what is your suggestion for people who want to start figuring stuff out about what's going to work for them, and whether low carb, high fat diets in their future? What do you think they should do?
Yeah. So I think just start with protein. Just pick it. I just tell my patients, pick eggs, cheese, beef, fish, chicken, any animal food. Just choose an animal food and eat it 3 times a day and just see how you feel. Focus on protein. Like, Lanny, I loved your story about how you were chronic dieting. So I see a lot of that too. So there's a lot of disordered eating and eating disorders because we've been dieting, and our moms have been dieting and our whole lives. And so if you just pick a protein, it doesn't even have to be a high fat diet. If you just meet your protein needs, and you can do that really, really easily by just picking an animal food to eat with every meal. And if you can do that for a little bit and just not think so much about what is in the food, but just that it's an animal food and it's healthy for your body, and just kind of reframe your thoughts about it, and enjoying it and being satisfied and satiated, protein will do the animal protein will do that for you every time, pretty much. So like for today, I don't know if we want to just share what we all ate today. That might be kind of interesting. I think I had eggs for breakfast with vegetables that my husband made. We put avocado and tomato in it and some pepper. I just do a little bit of vegetable when I do it. And then I had sourdough bread a couple times with butter. I had I actually had more eggs for lunch because we just didn't have anything made, so I ate eggs today probably. two pieces of sourdough bread with butter. I had for supper, I had like six meatballs that my Mexican meatballs that my husband made with a little Mexican tomato sauce and then more Mexican queso. And I had a lot of water today with a lot of salt in it. I had broth twice. So I just put a little bouillon cube in water. That's how I get my salt. What else did I have today? And then I had a little bit of low carb ice cream, and that's what I had today. And I feel awesome. I don't have any bloating, no digestive issues. I feel really good. I enjoyed every meal. So that's my goal every day with my food.
That's awesome.
Are we going around the horn saying what we did?
Yeah. I had chicken broth that I made this morning, and that's what I do instead of coffee in the morning. It's really good. That's how it helps me get salt too early on. And it helps me. And then I drink a bunch of water. And then I had a big hamburger patty with a couple slices of raw cheese and a slice of tomato and some lettuce that I shared with the baby. And that's it so far, because dinner will come next and I'm not sure what I'm making. But I think like I'll do tacos, you know, taco night or whatever. But then the corn shells or the tortillas are on the side for whoever wants them. Then you just build a taco salad, you know, because right. I'm not feeding grain to my baby yet either. He's 18 months. He's not quite there yet. Never Usually eat. I'll have some sourdough, but I didn't make any today.
Let's hear it, Deborah.
I chicken start nuggets. Every just the skin. I start every morning with a cup of coffee with a lot of milk.
Do heavy cream.
Yeah, I should switch. I low fat milk. So
low fat milk. You drink low fat.
I gotta switch it.
Why do you drink that into your house? I just want to hear the reasoning behind it. Why do you drink low fat milk? That's water with sugar in it, right?
It's just habitual.
Yeah.
But listening so interesting. Today, you know, I have a different
That's what you buy it. When you go to the store, you seek yes. out low fat milk.
Yeah, 1%
1%.
I'm yeah. sorry, that, excuse I mean, my the, language, but that's fucking crazy, Deborah. Why do you do why I mean
she doesn't know.
I don't
I
mean
I best, didn't know.
I did that for years too. I would never have thought of ever drinking regular milk. Like even 2% was like for a latte was like a splurge. And then to start buying whole milk when after I started researching all of this was really hard. And now we have, you know, only raw whole milk or heavy whipping cream for coffee in the house.
The stuff I put in my coffee is 40%.
Sometimes yeah. you just use butter. I mean, just
yeah,
yeah. for it. Yeah, we only do half and half heavy cream and whole milk in our house. So, yeah. but I grew up with the pink lid skim milk my whole
yeah.
life.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah, it looks gray, like yeah. translucent liquid. So besides just berating you sorry, for what you sorry, put in your Deborah. Coffee,
that's okay. That's
what
okay.
else did you have today?
I had a bowl of Kind cereal, and for lunch I had a salad with mixed greens and tomatoes and feta or goat cheese. And then I had a peach and I haven't had dinner yet.
So yeah, just find a replacement for that cereal. And that's like, that sounds good. You know, try some kind of animal protein for you in place of the cereal. And then eggs is a big deal. Like it's been hard to like be like for so long, I thought I could only eat egg whites and like, I feel so satisfied with egg, especially because it's our own chickens now. But then the nutrients that are in egg yolks, I mean, like choline, you can hardly get that any other place. That's super important for pregnancy. And I learned that during my pregnancy this time. Last time I was trying to diet in that old like Weight Watchers way with my first pregnancy, and it was not as easy as this one. It's like this, it's these things that are in our heads are super hard to like reverse. So just yeah. try it, get a small container of heavy whipping cream and try it in your coffee and be like, oh, this is really good. It, you know, and have that be okay. Like the really good doesn't mean it's bad for you. That's yeah. the yeah, trick.
There's
you know?
A really good book called, it's an older book, but it's called French Women Don't Get Fat. And it talks about how they'll eat like the heavy saturated fat, like heavy creams, croissants, like everything they eat is, but they don't eat large portions because they're satisfied, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the fat and the protein is what satisfies you and keeps you full.
Right.
Yeah. Fat Italian women's an American thing too.
Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. My turn.
You're up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Start of the day. I had coffee. I put an egg yolk from my chickens in the coffee. I whip it. I didn't have any half and half or whole heavy cream, so I put whole milk in it, Deborah, and local honey. Then I also had some leftover taco meat that I made last night that I just used like real spices to season, and it's grass-fed beef that I have in my freezer from a local cow, all one cow. And then I put 3 eggs on that, ate it. For lunch, my wife wanted to get sushi, so I ate sushi, which probably isn't the best because it's got soy and all that garbage in it. And then I haven't had dinner yet, so I think I'm gonna have pork chops from a local pig.
Cool. So you don't have to go above and beyond and go get a whole pig tomorrow, but just get a gallon of whole milk next time and see. Okay. See what happens. See, watch that you don't just die faint or like have 10 pounds on the scale the next time you step on it.
And I probably will need less of it anyway because it tastes better.
Yeah, tastes better. Yeah. And it satisfies mm-hmm. you.
I should have done, what was the joke in Napoleon Dynamite? Or what does he say to the glamour shots by Deb girl? She's like orders skim milk for lunch and he tells her that she could totally handle 2% if she wanted to.
Oh, I forgot that one. Yes.
Yeah.
So you could funny. Totally handle 2%.
Well,
and think of healthy fats are so good for your skin too. So Katie's the testament to that. Look at that.
Yeah.
Well, it's the lighting. It's just a little dim in here. I haven't slept in 5 years, Lanny.
Okay, I get that.
Katie, do you ever do appointments with people in places where you don't live over Zoom or anything like that?
I do. So I don't do any. So with my private practice, I'm not really doing medical nutrition therapy, but I do talk through things kind of like we did today. Just more of like a therapeutic type of conversation that I just get people to tap into their intuition through, you know, that's all I really am doing. Like the answers are already there. I'm just the one helping them figure that out.
Cool.
Fantastic. Yeah. You're a wealth of knowledge and, we covered a ton of stuff today. I know you can go super deep on conspiracies too, so we'd love to get you back and do more conspiracy stuff, even though we touched on it a little bit, but that's what we're all about here. But it's an important topic, and like realizing that there's an agenda behind it rather than just like, oh, there's money and stuff like that. There's a deeper meaning to all this, and I think a lot of people.
Yeah, don't stop at money when it comes to the food thing, because we know how bad it is. If anybody's listening, it's not about money. It's way more than that, is what I'll say.
Yeah, well, we'll get you back for part two, definitely. And thanks for making this happen, Lanny, and getting this on the book so quick.
You.
It was
thank
a little
you,
dead spot in our schedule. So I really appreciate it. Do you guys have any final words or thoughts or questions?
No, if you're putting this out right away, there's still time to sign up for the fermentation workshop this Sunday. And you're going to be there, right, Adam?
You got it.
Awesome. And
I'm not signed up yet, but I will be there.
Oh,
I'll sign up.
Cool. This one will be a fun one. And Katie, your website, is that Rhythm Nutrition?
Rhythmnutrition.net. Yep.
Okay, great.
Okay. I'll put that in the show notes for you.
Yeah.
And
hey, you guys are awesome. I told Lanny the idea of the show, Deborah, you're such a good sport, and we would all love to red pill our mothers and our mother-in-laws, and you're so awesome for it's such a clever, awesome idea. So cool.
It's all Adam.
You guys are just hysterical. I love it.
Right on. Thanks. That makes me happy. Well, thank you guys for being here and putting up with us, and we really, really appreciate it, Katie, and we'll be in contact in the future. And anybody that that's interested in all this stuff, reach out, because it's important. Sure. All right, guys, thanks for everything.
Thank you.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Guys,
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people. Oh, those black babies? Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots. Playing God all day. Deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites, Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all of that 7-story pervert.
building in New York? What a bunch of freaks! And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you's a piece of crap! And you're gonna be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turning us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed!
Mom, I'm transgender.